We're told that one of Ajahn Mun's favorite Dharma themes was the theme of practicing the Dharma in accordance with the Dharma. It's a theme that appears several times in the canon. In the story of the Buddha's last night, they tell of the devas sprinkling all sorts of divine offerings, divine flowers, divine incense, playing divine music in honor of the Buddha. And the Buddha tells one of his attendants that this is not how true homage is paid to the Buddha. True homage is paid through practicing the Dharma in accordance with the Dharma. In another passage, we're told that this is one of the factors for stream entry. You associate with good people. You listen to the Dharma. You apply appropriate attention both to the Dharma you've heard and to your experience. And then you practice the Dharma in accordance with the Dharma. On one level, this simply means that you're not practicing in accord with your likes and dislikes. In other words, you don't set a teaching aside simply because it doesn't appeal to you, which is an extremely important principle to think about, seeing how the Dharma is coming to the West. We look back in history and see how other cultures have adapted the Dharma to their cultural presuppositions. And some people take that as license. Why wait for 100 years to create an American Dharma when you can create it right now? Which, of course, means we close our ears to a lot of what the Dharma has to say. It would be better to look back at the people who, like Ajahn Mun, decided not to follow in line with their preferences. They did whatever the Dharma required. Those should be our examples. So a large part of the practice means putting aside your preconceived notions and your preferences and just listening to the Dharma as it actually is. But there's also a passage in the canon that actually defines what it means to practice the Dharma in accordance with the Dharma on a deeper level. That means practicing for the purpose of dispassion. Viraga is the term. One place the Buddha cites this as the highest Dharma, the foremost of all fabricated and unfabricated Dharmas, the dispassion that leads to total freedom. That's where we're headed. And again, this goes right against cultural prejudices, because so many people live their life through their passions. Without passion, they say there's no taste to life. This means, again, putting aside our prejudices and preferences and really looking at what life is all about. Dispassion is often paired with a word called nibbida. Disenchantment means developing a sense of distaste. Some people translate it even as strong as revulsion. It's related to the act of feeding, realizing that things you've been feeding on no longer hold any appeal. When you actually look at the process of feeding and look at all the suffering it entails, you decide to find a way out. Is there a state of mind? Is there happiness that doesn't have to depend on feeding? This was a huge theme in the Buddhist time. When we think about Buddhist philosophy, we tend to think of it, again, through our cultural lens of kind of philosophy that our philosophers have engaged in. Questions about epistemology, about metaphysics, psychology of perception. That gets the more intellectual side excited. You say, oh, the Buddha was talking about many of the same things that our philosophers have talked about. But when you read some of the other texts that date from the time of the Buddha, you realize that there was a huge philosophy around the topic of feeding, and we don't have any parallel for that in the West, at least not much. we're beginning to develop some sensitivity to what our feeding does to the environment. But back then, they had a very sophisticated philosophy around this. In the Upanishads, they talk about feeding quite a bit. This dates back to the Vedic obsession with the topic of feeding, because that's what the Vedic ritual was all about. You had to feed your ancestors who were dead and up in heaven, or wherever they'd gone after death. And you had to prepare for the fact that you were going to have to feed after you died as well. Or you wanted to propitiate the devas, you had to feed them through the sacrifice. So you can imagine that the Vedas had a very positive take on feeding, and the Upanishads carry that over. Yourself is food, one of them says. Without food, you start losing your faculties. You start losing your energy. So this is your true self. And feeding is a good thing. After all, it's what keeps the universe going. But the Buddha had a very different take. On the one hand, he did acknowledge the importance of feeding. The first question in the novice's questions, what is one? All beings subsist on food. But he had a very different take on it. It wasn't just physical food. He noticed that it was also the mind had its food as well, contact, consciousness, what he called intellectual intention, the things that the mind feeds on. And he said, if you want to find true release from suffering, you've got to learn how to get beyond these kinds of food. Physical food is the one that we're most intimately attached to. I say that people in the concentration camps, when they would first get there, the men were separated from the women, and the men would talk about sex for the first week or so, and then they lost interest as their energy went down, and then all I could think about was food. It's a deeper attachment. It's probably our deepest physical attachment is to food. And our mind is compulsively attached to its feeding as well, always looking for new things to feed on. The Buddha said you've got to look at it in a different way. In the case of physical food, he gives the story of the couple who have to kill their child in order to survive when going across the desert. And then they make jerky out of the child's flesh. And he said, what would be their attitude towards eating that jerky as they continue their trip? Would they eat it out of enjoyment and pleasure, infatuation? Well, no. Huge amount of regret. That survival required this kind of feeding, this kind of food. And we say you should look at all your food that way. This, of course, goes against the grain, but again, you have to look at what feeding does, how it chains you to your food source, how it's oppressive on all these beings that have to provide the food, and not just the actual animals who form the food, but the people who work in the food chain. This is why we have reflection on our food every day, so that we eat not out of enjoyment or playfulness or desire to put on bulk, but simply to keep the body alive, strong enough so we can practice. The same principle applies to the other forms of food as well. He said to look at these other metal forms of food as a cow that's been flayed and it's been attacked by insects all the time. Or a man who's being dragged into a pit of burning embers, constantly burned by his awareness of things. Or a man who's approaching execution and is being stabbed by 300 spears a day. In other words, all the basic food that the mind feeds on is this constant irritation, this constant assault. You learn to look at it that way. That tends to direct your mind more towards the idea that maybe dispassion would be a good thing. The Buddha's analysis of suffering, he talks about the clinging aggregates. The word for clinging also means sustenance. So the mind takes sustenance off of these things. Form, feeling, perception, fabrication, consciousness. This whole image of feeding and taking sustenance is central to the Buddha's teachings on suffering. So you have to learn to look at both at the way we eat physical food and the way we take in mental food. Look at it in a way that gives rise to a sense of distaste and dispassion. That's how you practice the Dharma in accordance with the Dharma. Now, as the Buddha discovered, though, in order to continue that practice, the mind needs good, strong state of concentration. Because what you're doing essentially is taking one of the what we take as our central pleasure in life, this constant physical and mental feeding. We're trying to wean ourselves away from it. And there's no way you can do that without some sort of sense of pleasure and well-being to give you strength along the way. We all know that his first insight into the major factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, the right concentration, came when he realized that after been starving himself, essentially for 6 years, that it was a form of pleasure that was blameless. And he actually talks about jhana as food in another analogy. But in order to partake of that blameless pleasure, he did have to eat. So the path does require a certain type of feeding. Again, that's our relationship to physical food should be in line with that reflection we have every day. I take this not for pleasure or for beautification or for playfulness or intoxication, but simply to keep the body alive, strong enough to continue the practice. You eat so as to overcome the pangs of hunger, but not so much that you stuff yourself and become uncomfortable from eating too much. We have to keep reminding ourselves of that every day. And John Fung once said that if you really take that contemplation seriously, it's enough to take you all the way to non-returning. It's that central, it's that important to practicing the Dharma in accordance with the Dharma. And of course, there's the image of jhana as food. And the Buddha gives the example of the practice of defending a fortress on the frontier. You need mindfulness as your watchman, and you need discernment as the plaster covering on your walls so the enemy can't climb your walls. And then you need food. And he compares the different stores of food to the different levels of jhana. The first jhana is like water and grass. The second jhana and third jhana are like rice and beans. And the fourth jhana is like butter, ghee, honey. These states of concentration are our food all along the way. So as we develop a taste for this kind of food, and we can begin to develop a sense of distaste and dispassion for the other kinds of mental food that we've been searching out and gobbling down all these many, many lifetimes. So that's what we're working on right here, right now, is to develop a basis for learning dispassion towards other things. So when the mind sits and is very still, you can start looking at your pride, you can start looking at your opinions, looking at all the other things by which you define yourself and shore up and nourish your sense of who you are, what you like, what you don't like. And you can learn how to cast a skeptical eye on these things. Begin to realize that that kind of feeding is really pretty miserable. The cow, the flayed cow, the men being tortured. You think about your thoughts, the things that you feed on in that light. And without nourishment of jhana, that kind of reflection would get very old very fast. Which is why you need what John Fuyen called the lubrication of jhana. That's the oil part of the ghee and the oil and the honey. The pleasure and the rapture, the the intense sense of well-being that come when you really get the mind centered and can tap into that center as much as possible. Ultimately, of course, you're going to have to develop a dispassion for this as well. There's even a passage where the Buddha says you have to watch out for a Dhamma passion for the deathless. You can, after analyzing all your other attachments, learn how to stop feeding on things outside of your concentration. Then you have to learn to look at the concentration itself and see that it's made up of the same kind of stuff that you've been feeding on outside. There's an aspect of concentration which corresponds to form, another corresponds to feeling, perception, thought constructs, and consciousness. I mean, the five aggregates are right there. And you learn how to look at those in the same way that you looked at your old food outside. That, he says, inclines the mind to the deathless. That can either lead to arahantship, or if you're attached to that passion for that dharma, it can prevent full awakening. This is why he has the contemplation of the not-self. Not only applied to fabricated things, but even to the unfabricated, even to the dispassion. It's possible to have passion for dispassion, turns out. Which is why they say the arahant is beyond both passion and dispassion, and beyond all dharmas. That's what the practice of the dharma in accordance with the dharma leads. It finally takes you beyond all dharmas. But the good part of what it means is there's no longer any need for feeding. The well-being, the happiness that lies at the end of the path frees you from all of the drawbacks of having to feed. So think of that as you find your mind nibbling on this and gobbling down that, that you'd be much, much better off if you're nibbling and gobbling on good, strong states of concentration. Because it's a blameless food. And it can lead you even further to a point where the mind is no longer strapped down to having feed anywhere. I'm thinking about this topic. I often think about the canyons in Zion National Park. There are many, many canyons that nobody goes to because they're really hard to get to. It takes a long time to schlep up and down the rock because if you're going to see them, you have to carry all that food with you. And as one of the rangers there once said, you can't eat the scenery. Wherever you go, you've got to carry your food. It's a burden. When you think about all the places in the world you could see, if you didn't have to feed, the body had an inner energy that just keep going and going and going. Like the Energizer Rabbit. But even better than Energizer Rabbit, it wouldn't require any input at all. Even the Energizer Rabbit eventually runs out. But imagine the freedom of being able to go anywhere at all and not having to carry anything with you. The Buddha sometimes talks about the monk who's so content with what he's got that he goes wherever he wants with only his robes and bowl as his burden, the same way the bird has only its wings as his burden. But if you didn't have to feed, you wouldn't even need that. Totally free to go anywhere you wanted. When you think in this way, you realize how much feeding is an enslaving thing. It's hard on those that have to function as food, but it's also an enslavement for the person who has to feed. So as you train the mind so that it doesn't have to feed, one, you're taking a burden off of others, and two, you're freeing your mind. That's why disenchantment and dispassion really are the highest dhammas. And why the practice of the dharma in accordance with the dharma, leading beyond all dharmas, is the best thing to which you can devote your life.